what she heard.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this day, the 21st of August. It is a Wednesday, and we thank you very much for being with us 9:12 on this morning. And we welcome you. We welcome you to be a part of our program. We welcome you to listen. We welcome you to sit back, hear what we have to say, what the wonderful panel has to say about the issues. And of course, if you wish to respond to such, by going to panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We have a lot to talk about today. Night two of the Democratic National Convention last night in the city of Chicago, Illinois. A night that was highlighted by both speeches by both Mr. and Mrs. Obama. Michelle Obama and Barack Obama both speaking at the convention, and as well as Doug Emhoff, the husband of Kamala Harris and the current second gentleman. So it was quite an evening, a lot going on, and we will talk about that this morning. Let me introduce the group to you. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's so great to be back after a bit of a hiatus. And Lasney's having its first golf classic September 23rd. So anyone who loves to play golf, which I do, should come out.
Legal Aid Society of New York.
Yes.
Okay.
Lasney.org.
Lasney.org.
LASNY.org.
And you can find out more information. I don't play golf. Are you a good golfer?
I'm not, but I play a lot. I'm barely average. But here's what I will say. I have a spinal disability, and golf has been a more accessible sport for me than sports that I used to do, which were like high peak hikes and stuff. So like,
yeah,
you know, instead of getting stuck in the middle of the mountains, I can get in the cart if I'm having trouble. So there's been a real transition in my lifestyle. But I love it. It's really fun.
But I'm guessing it doesn't really matter what your skill level is. This is you're out for a good cause. You have a good time.
Yeah, it's a scramble, and we have some really silly games. You know, best costumes and just putting games. So it doesn't matter.
Golfing in costume.
I mean, that Halloween's my favorite holiday. So, you know, I'm trying to bring a little flavor to.
Lasney.org, and I can find out more information. We'll hear a little bit more about that later on. Thank you for being here. We missed you. It's good to have you back. Jay Jochnowitz joins us, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer at the Times Union newspaper. Good morning, Jay. How are you?
I'm well, Joe. How are you?
I'm well. I just want to take a moment to note the passing of Dr. Alice Green yesterday, passed away at the age of 84. One of the great Albanians, someone who just, I think, personified this city, did such amazing work. She did incredible work. Did she piss people off in the process? Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
But did they realize in the end that she was probably doing the right thing? Yes, I think so. And she was an amazing, amazing woman. We're going to have did an interview with her when her memoir came out in 2021, and we're going to dedicate our 11 o'clock hour to Dr. Alice Green and just be reminded of the amazing work that she has done, not only in this community, but across the state and really across the country. You've worked with her.
Yes. And Lasney has a long time relationship with the center. And, you know, we're here to support the community as well. But as a civil rights activist, really, you know, makes a big hole, I think, in a lot of our activist community's hearts.
I assume she had a lot to say to the Times Union at times.
She did, and I had a nice relationship with her over the years, even even at one point when I was doing a voter's guide and she was running for, I'm trying to remember the office she was running for, but she never got back to me. She gave me an email. Her campaign gave me an email. We sent emails to it, and she just never responded. And then the day the voter's guide came out, she called and said, "Jay, I'm not in your voter's guide. It says that I did not respond, and I never got a questionnaire." And I said, "Alice, I sent it to your email," and I gave her the email. She goes, "Oh, I haven't been reading that email. I use a different one now.
Yeah.
And she was so forgiving and so kind about it. Another candidate, you know, just might have said, you know, this is your responsibility right. that I didn't read
your
the email that
you
gave me.
Right.
You know, and I, you know, and with all the trouble she caused for people over the years, she could have really lambasted me over that. And we were just so civil, you know. And it's such a minor thing in the scheme of things that this is one of the things I remember about her, because she was so tough and so strong and so consistent and so unshakable. You know, she just never stopped. And I was in tears yesterday, to be honest.
I was too. And I will say, I mean, I was shocked. She was. I just saw her not too long ago, and I was shocked she was 84.
Yeah.
I mean, if you told me she was 70, I wouldn't have believed that. Yeah. But my goodness, what a powerhouse yeah. and an amazing woman. We'll be remembering her in our 11 o'clock hour.
And truth to power.
Oh,
I mean,
goodness.
she was not an imposing person.
No.
I mean, not in the way I knew her anyway. And she just never flinched.
Well, and as this radio station, and I wasn't here at this time, but when this radio station was getting underway and we were doing a series of public affairs programs, she was a constant fixture yeah. on the station and such a part. I know a lot of that information now resides at the SUNY Albany Archives. There's an Alice Green Archive, and there's also a WAMC Archive, and there's all that information is in there. And it's just really cool. And so anyway, we miss her, and we send our profound condolences to Charles Tuohy, her husband, and to her family, and to all those who knew her. It's quite a day thinking of an Albany without Alice Green. I want to go back to introductions, because I don't know if you all knew this, but it's Bring a Friend to Work Day. And Jim Hendler is a Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. And Jim, first of all, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Really nice to have you with us. And thanks. You bring a very cool special guest with you this morning. Would you like to introduce him? And if not, I can. I have all the information if you don't.
I was going to say, I could talk for about an hour and a half about NOSH, so why don't you take one?
Okay. So NOSH Contractor is the Jane and William White Professor of Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University and past president of the International Communication Association. So welcome to the program. Very nice to have you here.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks, Jim, for inviting me to this. Delighted to be here.
So how have the two of you worked together over the years? How did you get to know each other?
Well, I think web science is what brought us together. So web science is this interdiscipline where after the computer was invented, we got the field of computer science. After web, we thought, well, there should be something called web science, about how web shapes society and society shapes the web. And Jim and others who were beginning this initiative decided that they needed somebody who was not a bona fide computer scientist, somebody who came out of the behavioral and social sciences, and reached out to me. And I've enjoyed being a part of that community now for over a decade.
Yeah, we have a trust in Britain called the Web Science Trust, which helps support the growth of the field. I used to chair the board when NOSH was on the board. NOSH is now the managing director of the organization. That's why he's here today, so he can talk me into doing stuff.
That's right. That's right.
The International Communication Association, I was reading about this organization last night. Give folks a sense of what
sure.
they're about.
It is by far the largest academic association for scholars around the world who are interested in studying communication and its impacts in society. A very small deal, as you can imagine, in this world today. And it is one that looks at all facets of communication, starting with mass communication, social media, but all the way down to interpersonal communication, family communication, health communication. And it has about 8,000-plus members in 80-plus countries around the world, and has chapters now in several parts of the world, regional chapters. It's been exciting to be a part of that community.
And home base for you currently, Chicago?
Evanston, Illinois.
Evanston, Illinois.
A collar suburb, a collar suburb of Chicago, indeed, yes.
And so you got out of Dodge.
I did. Yesterday, I got an alert when I was flying out. The United Airlines sent me an alert saying, you may have heard there's a convention in town, so try to get to the airport 3 hours before.
3 hours. Wow. My goodness. Well, it's I'm wondering if you had any place to go, I'm glad you came here. You're with us.
Also worth noting that Nosh has, I think, about 5 million air miles on at least 4 different airlines.
That's just a minor exaggeration. But, yes, it is. It's true that I do a bit of traveling. I'm happy to be back in Albany. I've been here a while ago. I've already learned something new. I did not know that y'all refer to yourselves as Albanians, so there you go. I'm learning every minute.
Yeah, well, that's what we strive for here on the program.
Wait till we go over to the Trojan side of the river.
True.
We welcome you all to be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Night 2 of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and which is even beamed into Evanston, I hear. And former President Barack Obama and former First Lady Michelle Obama, two of the Democratic Party's most popular figures, electrified delegates at the party's convention Tuesday, saying they saw the same sense of excitement and hope that characterized their own rise to the White House, now surrounding Kamala Harris. I'm feeling hopeful because this convention has been pretty good to kids with funny names who believe in a country where anything is possible, Barack Obama said. Reference to his emergence as a political star at the 2004 convention, because we have the chance to elect someone who spent her whole life trying to give people the same chances America gave her. This from the Washington Post. The former president sought to frame the election as a stark choice. We don't need 4 more years of bluster and chaos. We've seen that movie, and we all know that the sequel is usually worse. America is ready for a new chapter. America is ready for a better story. We are ready for President Kamala Harris. The former First Lady, whose appearance was greeted with particular emotion, even prompting some delegates to cry, also took on Republicans who have disparaged Harris as incompetent, calling her, quote, one of the most qualified people ever to seek the office of the presidency, and she needled Trump over a recent comment that undocumented immigrants are taking, quote, black jobs. Who's going to tell him that the job he currently is seeking might just be one of those black jobs, she said.
Great line.
All right, let's go around the room and get reactions from you all about last night's proceedings. It doesn't have to be about these two speeches. It can be about any part of the convention. But, Nick, we'll let you go first.
Well, I was saying earlier that I recently got to meet and hear from Obama's previous speechwriter, Terry Splatt, and it was really fun and fantastic to listen to Obama's speech last night and hear some of the, I guess, true and tried, I want to say, linguistics of the, like, Obama speech. It was fun. It was energizing. It had good hard hits, but really focused more on all the great things that Kamala is bringing to the ticket, which I really appreciated. And it was just a lot of fun. And also, Lil Jon as the hype man for the DNC conference is amazing to me. So
For Georgia. He wasn't even for the whole convention.
I really appreciate the youth emphasis, the generation of hip hop being really integrated into the DNC convention too, which is which I adore. So
yeah, I was going to say, you know, it's they started the roll call, which this year was technically not necessary, but they wanted to do the hoopla, and that allowed some of the states to really pull off some stuff. But meanwhile,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it was done virtually in advance
to allow
Ohio to get their votes in because there was a kerfuffle there. And
so that was taken care of. But so they had done a virtual roll call. So I forgot exactly what they called this, the confirmation
roll call.
But the amazing thing was, you know, you compare it to the Republican convention. So up on the stage, you have not only the guy who's calling the names of the states, but a DJ doing, you know, the double album things and the scratches. But each state, he picked a different song to represent them. And I mean, it was just all energy. It was and it was, you know, the theme of this thing has been joy and hope and, you know, really rebuilding a lot of that stuff. And the contrast to sort of the dour and mean talks that were at the Republican convention versus the just uplifting talks here has just been such a contrast.
Nash.
Yeah, I think I'll build on both these points. And for many years, these conventions have been seen as events that brought the country together. The highly choreographed, that sort of is a celebration of Americana and the best of it. And I think for the last few cycles, that feeling has dampened a little bit. It has had some of the enthusiasm taken out of it. There have been occasions, as we know from the Obama conventions, but in general, partly because of the fragmentation of the media, it doesn't get the same kind of ratings. It wasn't the same kind of media event that it had been in decades past. I think this brought some of that back again. It brought that color, it brought the excitement, it brought the energy back again. Now, there were moments where, like the Oscar ceremonies, not necessarily last night, but on the first night, there were moments like, you know, you need to start playing the violin and get some people off the stage. But last night had a lot of good energy to it and a lot of joy. And I think they really are focusing on the younger generation and trying to draw as much audience, this time not necessarily on three or four major networks, but also through social media.
And it really, they brought the train in on time. That was good.
Indeed.
Jay, we have just, I don't want to short you on time. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll hear your comments in full so we don't have to have the expurgated version.
Okay.
We'll take a break and we welcome your comments, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Nick Rangel, Nosh Contractor, Jim Hendler, and Jay Jochnowitz joining us this morning, and we do welcome your thoughts. We'll have a brief break and then news from the BBC before we return with more.
So I'll go and send it on its way.
Listening to Chris Jones and the Night Drivers, they're playing Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs tomorrow. That's Thursday, the 22nd of August, for those of you keeping score at home. Cafe Lena, that's two Fs, cafelena.org, and you can find out more information. The music will be played going into our breaks this morning. The playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. We are talking about night two of the Democratic National Convention, coming to us from the city of Chicago, Illinois. We've heard from most of our panel members. We go to Jay Jochnowitz.
So, there's a couple of takeaways from last night that I was thinking about at the time, and I've been thinking about more as, digesting it. I mean, the convention is, you know, ultimately a time to rally the troops. I think you're right. We don't watch it as much as we used to. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of that as well. I did not watch as much of either of the conventions as I feel I should have both as a journalist and a citizen. But of course, you've got YouTube to catch up on everything. Right. But I was struck through the not so much through the speeches. The speeches were very energizing. But I was struck through the symbolic or whatever it was, casting of the votes. I don't think we would have seen quite the explosion. It was just amazing. The sustained energy through that process. I don't think we would have seen quite that level of enthusiasm if Biden was at the top of the ticket. And I think there's been a real turnaround for the Democratic Party and particularly at the presidential level. And it's been apparent through this convention how much energy there is, and that's what's going to matter, because these people are the, you know, kind of the, they're the workers. They're the team captains who are going to go out there and energize the troops. And it was interesting to me as well that so many of the faces we saw last night speaking on behalf of the states were black. I think it was a real concern for the Democratic Party in the weeks leading up to Biden's withdrawal that the polls were starting to show that that support was eroding among black voters. Not to the point that it was, you know, anywhere near a majority going for Trump, but it was certainly enough to say, what is going on? This is troubling. This is the backbone of the Republican Party's vote. And if they lose that, that's a bad thing. So, I thought that what my takeaway from it, from all of this so far, has been that it's a really energized party that was a few weeks ago, you know, just wearing sackcloth and ashes for months. Yeah. And rightly so. It was not a good, you know, things were not looking good.
So I thought the best line, though, of the whole roll call vote was when we got to New York. And Governor Hochul said, you know, we're from New York, the greatest state. And there were some muttering. And she said, hey, we're from New York. Get over it. I'm like, yeah, that's my state. But actually, she gave a really, really good speech on Monday. The, you know, the audience wasn't quite there yet. And so, you know, if you watch it like on YouTube where they're just focused on her, it doesn't. It's clearly a good speech, but you're not hearing the crowd. Then I saw it later on a YouTube where they had actually taken it from the back where you could actually see the responses. And, you know, she got a really good response.
She had a line in there about how they would elect Kamala to be the first president of the United States. I don't know. It just seemed it was a little clunky.
She had a few clunks. But the overall
speeches tend to have – you know, a line or two that come out a little clunky, right? I mean,
it was a hard room. I mean, look, as Jim said, I mean, she was the first person in the primetime slot. So, yeah.
Well, the other thing I really loved, and this is, you know, the way they countered a lot of Trump's accusations against Kamala without being so obvious about it. So Trump actually called Kamala anti-Semitic. Right. Kamala's husband comes out and starts with a story about his bar mitzvah. Right. I mean, but, yeah. You know, for me, the president of a synagogue, I'm like, you know, he's just convinced a whole lot of people.
Yeah. He's talking about going to Hebrew school. It was very much,
built on that. And then, you know, sort of. The embarrassing phone call and that she makes him listen to.
Didn't you want to hear it? I wanted to hear it. I wanted to hear it.
Well, Thursday night is their anniversary. It'll be really interesting.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, tease the crowd a little bit. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you and what you think about what is going on. Let's see. I want to go to the music accompaniment was outstanding. Some of the great connections made between state and music were New Jersey, of course, Bruce, Minnesota, Prince, South Carolina, James Brown, West Virginia, John Denver, Idaho, B-52's Private Idaho. Such great energy, and that's from T in East Chatham. Yes, that was obviously well choreographed. Just wanted to share a metaphor. Donald Trump rode the escalator to the bottom. Kamala Harris will take it back to the top. That from Don this morning. I'd like to address the issue that came up yesterday. When I think about this, it has nothing to do with the Biden administration, which I think has been remarkable. But when we talk about the country going in the wrong direction, it is the unethical and politicized Supreme Court. It is the percent of people that believe that political violence is acceptable. It is the hate, racism, and anti-Semitism that is rising. It is the rise in conspiracy theories and disinformation. I think you need to know where people are coming from when they answer that question of whether the country is going in the wrong direction or not. This came out of a statement from one of our panelists about a poll that said that
60% of the people believe that the country is going in the wrong direction. Thanks for a wonderful program. That is from Natalie.
I would add to that list, you know, there, I don't know that there was ever a perfect time when Congress, and the, especially when there was not, when there were opposing parties in Congress, that there was ever a time when everybody worked together in some great kumbaya moment. But, you know, there probably were moments like that over our lifetimes. I would add to that that we have a Congress, we have a situation in Congress where it is almost impossible to get anything done if there is either an opposing party in control of one of the houses, or in the Senate, you just have a determined minority that, that will filibuster anything. And I think that's part of the, you know, the concern. I hope the Democrats continue, as they did last night, to hammer home the point that we had a solution, a bipartisan solution. It may not have been everything you wanted it to be, to immigration. And Donald Trump stepped in and said, no. That's my whole campaign, or half of it anyway. Don't pass that. And all of a sudden, a solution that had been negotiated by one of the most conservative members of the chamber fell apart.
Right.
That is not how a responsible government works, and so I would add that to that very thoughtful list.
Linda writes, as a key to this, you're speaking about highly interested people who nonetheless didn't see the entirety of the DNC last night, given the time zone difference. Yes, there is YouTube, but if any of you can identify a link that captures a substantive portion of both Obama's speeches, that would be a great service to your audience. Just go on C-SPAN. C-SPAN has it all there.
The whole thing.
Yeah, you just link it in, and they'll bring it up.
Although I have to give Obama credit for the one daring thing of the night. It was a little juvenile.
It was great.
You know what I'm talking
about.
Yes. I mean, you had to see it, and so I urged the
I was wondering how choreographed, like how long that took to practice that. But he made a size joke. And just with the hands, and it was perfectly executed, juvenile, sure, but perfectly executed in a way that you could get out of it going, what? I didn't do anything.
I didn't do anything. I just looked down for a moment. That's all. Oh God, it was that moment in The Godfather when she did that about Sonny Corleone. Yeah, just wanted to mention one other thing about last night, probably many other things, but the point that somebody said said it last night, or Michelle said it, about Kamala Harris being one of the most qualified people. And, you know, I remember that was constantly said about Hillary as well, that she had earned this position. And it always felt to me, and I hope this doesn't come out wrong or terrible, but it always felt to me that we were talking about the smart girl in school. And she, unfortunately, all these stars in the party were saying how great she was, but she did not, for too many people, did not project. She didn't connect with enough people. So she was, I think she was. She was one of the most qualified candidates to ever run for president. But she, there's one more qualification she was missing, and that was the ability to connect with people who didn't necessarily want to be connected with. And that's, I think, the challenge going into Thursday, is how well Kamala Harris, after all the buildup, is able to show us that she can not just be qualified, but project everything she needs to just connect with people. I guess.
Right. You know, I think the other thing that they did that was just amazing was, so she and Tim Walz were holding a rally over in, I think it was Milwaukee. In a huge hall. In fact, I think it was the hall where the Republicans were, right? Mm-hmm. Filled it completely, which they even during the convention had some empty seats. But then they also had the Democratic convention, the even bigger arena with even more people. So, you know, sort of just the crowd, the noise, the size. But then after the, quote, confirmation vote, they actually cut over to her
Yes.
In there on a live feed mm-hmm. where she could announce to the crowd that over in Chicago they had just it was just the right use of the kind of technologies that get picked up on modern social media. I've said this before mm-hmm. on this show that, and Nash could probably say way more than I can about this, but you know, Obama picked up on a certain zeitgeist of what was happening on Twitter. Trump, really, while he was very visible on Twitter, where he really played out a lot was on Facebook, mm-hmm. right? I really think Kamala has her pulse on TikTok, Instagram. So where the 18 to 35, 40-year-olds are, which is a huge demographic to get out and a very difficult demographic to get out. And I think the connection she is making there, you know, I use the example, my sister has an 18-year-old daughter who's going to be voting for the first time this year and was, you know, going to sort of hold her nose and vote for Biden because otherwise her mother was going to disown her if she voted for Trump or didn't vote. But now it's like my sister says every day she's getting something from her kid on, you know, whatever messaging platform they're using that, oh, my God, did you know that so-and-so came out? You know, this rock star, this hip-hop artist. Did you see this TikTok? Did you see, you know, it's like the enthusiasm of an 18-year-old who has been pretty much tuned out of politics her whole life. And then I have a 36-year-old who represents some of the community's disability, non-gender, et cetera, says what you see building in that community, same thing. They were, you know, they were going to vote for Biden because they sort of had to. Now they're signing up, they're getting involved, they believe they have somebody who's really going to understand the kind of life they have. And that really has been something I've noticed. Again, it's not going to be an easy election, but it was really good to see.
It'll be interesting to see how the efforts in the very short span of time that's left, how the efforts to suppress those votes proceed. So you see it often every year with regularity, and it's not just the Republicans that do this. Democrats will do it locally, college campuses, trying to figure out how to stifle the college vote by making either polling places less accessible to students or something like that, because that's where you're going to see that vote come out, is or some of it coming from colleges. Yeah. On local votes.
Nash?
Yeah, I was going to say that the use of technology in each of these election cycles has been quite significant. And as Jim pointed out, almost each one was the coming out party for one particular media channel, whether it was Facebook or Twitter, X. And correctly, as Jim points out, Insta and TikTok have really been extremely useful. Now, it's not to say that the other candidates have not tried to use it, but there is a certain native sense in which the Kamala Harris campaign has been able to use this that goes beyond what traditional political campaigns have done in this area. The other technology that people haven't spoken as much about but has been very influential is, believe it or not, Zoom.
Yes.
We came to Zoom initially thinking about it as something that rescued us during COVID. But this campaign has really taken Zoom to a whole new level in terms of orchestrating massive online audiences that have broken records and has actually literally broken the Zoom technology by having so many people show up at these events. And so that, again, is a new use of a technology that we had been associating only with the COVID crisis.
Yeah, what a great way to launch from, you know, COVID technology. You have these college students who have been in Zoom University for 5 years.
Yes. They're
extremely comfortable. They're like native Zoom users, right? And be able to just capitalize on that for a campaign of this magnitude. It's really tremendous, right?
Well, but also it's not just that group. It's they've had special outreach events,
mm-hmm.
and it's to, you know, black women, white males,
exactly.
And every one of them has gotten tens or hundreds, tens of thousands. Yeah. You can't really get into hundreds.
It's been
picked up on the live streams as well.
They also have a huge, like a much larger volunteer base than the GOP right now, right? And they have a much greater grassroots reach into more remote and rural areas than I think the DNC has typically had, which is pretty impressive. If you look at the map of where those volunteer hubs are, they're getting to the heart, to the center. It's not just the coasts, which I think is powerful data.
We're running very late, so let me get a break in, and when we come back, we'll continue with the letters and with a conversation with our panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Whistle blow, so she won't know. Tears are falling.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let's go right into the letters. Gene writes, Joe, the nitpicking. These aren't professional announcers like you. These are politicians. They're excited. Hochul flubbed a word. Well, that's the takeaway we should talk about. Goodness gracious. It's like complaining about them going along while ignoring the reason. All the cheering. Okay, Gene, I get your point. And it is, it's a good point. However, one thing I will say about Hochul, I'm not beating up, I'm merely stating, but that flub and that made, I believe, 3 out of the 5 late night comedy shows. So I get it, but that also has a life of its own. And especially when we were doing the same thing with Biden and they took the nomination away from him. So I think there is a point to be made on that.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I want to tie it, too, back to our earlier discussion about Hillary Clinton's inability to connect with audiences in her speeches. I just was kind of going back to 2016, and NPR had a headline that was digging into why does Hillary Clinton's speeches not land on audiences? And, you know, speeches are the primary way that candidates get their key points across, but also how they gain sort of adoration and admiration. They have to be able to express their humility, their humanity, but they also have to do it in an enthusiastic but crisp way, right? And it is a quality that only the most excellent professional politicians really ever achieve. Not every excellent politician does always achieve it either, right? But speeches are really important, and every single word is criticized by every press outlet on the planet. So, you know, it may be a really nitpicky thing on Hochul's particular speech, but everybody is paying attention to every single word being said at the convention, and every word is kind of, you know, eligible for critique, right?
And you can't fake sincerity. Yeah. This is way off the Hochul thing, I guess, but you can't fake sincerity either. And that's what I think. Hillary in person is pretty good. One-on-one, I've met her. I've met Hochul in person. They're nice people. But then they get in front of a group and they get a little robotic. And, you know, I think about, we were talking off the air about these two folks from West Virginia. There was the oldest person in the delegation and the youngest person in the delegation. So you had an 83-year-old who got out there. And she had prepared remarks and they were written out. But when she delivered them, you could feel the sincerity in it. And when the 18-year-old got out there and delivered her remarks, you know she had practiced them. But she just, it just came out of her. It poured out of her. And it doesn't always work. So anyway, Hochul missing a line says, I think, more about her style of speaking publicly than just a nitpick.
Well, and it's too bad, right? Like, we have these incredible women who are extremely educated. They're exceptionally well qualified. They're, you know, excellent leaders in every way. Mm-hmm. But the expectation is also that they have to electrify crowds. Yeah. And that is true. You do have to electrify crowds, but I think the expectation on women is even heavier. It's a bigger burden. There's a higher hurdle there to overcome.
So two notes on that. One is that I thought Hillary Clinton's speech was electrifying. I thought it was amazing. And it was well written and it was beautifully delivered. And she seemed just joyful. It was really great. So then we have this letter, which I think is interesting. Once again, taking us to task a little bit. I'm amazed that no one has really talked about Michelle Obama's barn burner of a speech. She had the arena wrapped, crying and roaring with enthusiasm. Barack was cool and articulate as usual, but had nowhere near the attention or enthusiasm of the crowd. You are talking about more about him than her. What gives, guys? Question mark.
Well, he's the president, you know, that's a thing, I suppose.
I will say, I mean, it was an amazing speech.
Both gave incredible.
Yeah. I mean, 100%. I do think that Obama being Obama gave more of a political meat and potatoes speech where Michelle was talking to the people, and this is what's going on, folks, and this is what we need to do.
And by the way, I just want to say we did open saying nice things about Michelle and pointing out some of her key lines, so maybe that person tuned in a little late.
I liked her preacher touches, she just it was the asides, it was the now listen to me.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And y'all. She threw in a couple of y'alls.
Yes. And as a native North Carolinian, y'all sticks with us, all right? Yeah. We can't get rid of it. I sound like I'm from New York until I throw some y'alls in there, you know?
Yeah. No, she was good.
I was just going to throw one other great line, which was J.B. Pritzker, who gave one of the talks. So the governor of Illinois, who is a billionaire, gets up and says, you know, as a real billionaire, let me tell you, and I'm sitting there going, you know, I can't imagine the Democrats ever having been willing to do that before. But now they understand that, you know, like someone who can put Trump in his place really helps. It was, again, another one of those just one minute, one clincher and amazing.
It's part of the subtle ways of getting at it without saying the other person is not the billionaire in that case. I think the idea that that we were discussing also about the flubs that were made by individuals, I think the brilliance sometimes is not in making the mistake, but being able to appropriate that mistake and make it to your advantage. I mean, if you think of all the memes that were generated by Kamala initially ridiculing her about the laughter, about the coconut, and here she has now been her campaign, and she have turn that around to her advantage and now has become a positive. And I think that we see this on both sides. I mean, you know, ironically, when Trump's mugshot became a selling point for him on the T-shirts, but the idea that sometimes we have something that looks like a downside, but then are able to turn it around and put it on the positive side.
Lemonade with those lemons.
Oh, indeed.
That's right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We've got a great group this morning. I'll introduce them to you when we come back, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. We will return after news with Ray Graff.
The price of
all right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We've got a great group this morning. Nick Rangel is here, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Jay Jochnowitz, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer at the Times Union. Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration, Jim Hendler, and NOSH Contractor, Jane and William White, Professor of Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University and past president of the International Communication Association. We want to tap into some of Nasha's knowledge here by just taking a simple example from the last 24 hours where former President Trump shared a fake image of Vice President Harris at a communist event. Looking a lot like the Democratic National Convention, Trump repeatedly called Harris Comrade Kamala, accusing her of supporting socialist policies during a rally and in fundraising emails. His remarks referenced Harris's recent economic proposal targeting price gouging. The Harris campaign has yet to comment on Trump's posts. And after a while, I think that job probably just gets a little overwhelming. So there, I mean, there she is. It's a picture. I see it. It's right in front of God and everybody. There she is talking to the crowd at the DNC and the sickle, the flag, the whole thing. It's all there.
Absolutely. I think this the idea of how misinformation and fake news has evolved over the last few presidential cycles and campaigns has been really interesting. For initially, when social media came about, the question was anyone could post anything on that particular issue. And so you'd see the notion of information being believed that you, because you saw it yourself and or other right. people saw it. And of course, that entire industry of creating that has become so much easier because of technologies, because of AI, whether it is visuals, but it's not just Photoshop anymore. It can be much better in sophisticated ways of looking at it. What the research has shown us on that particular topic is that there is a definite systematic bias where information that is considered as misinformation, which is just something that somebody made up, or disinformation where it was intentionally propagated to serve some goal. And this example that you just gave would be an example of disinformation because it had a certain purpose, tends to travel much faster and much more quickly and reach much larger audiences than traditional information. And one may say, how does that happen? And it is because it's somewhat unique, it is somewhat novel, but there the research, especially work that was done by a colleague of mine, Sinan Aral, who is at MIT, who did a massive global project that showed systematically that the speed, the velocity, as he calls it, of this information and the depth with which this information gets through is remarkable. Now, some of you may remember that there was a quote that a lie goes twice around the world before truth put on its boots.
Yep. Yeah.
And do you know who said that? Well, the general notion about it was that that was said by Mark Twain. Yeah. It turns out that also is misinformation.
Of course. It was Abraham Lincoln.
So, I think I saw that on TV. No, actually, I'm not sure, but it is an example of how misinformation about that topic.
I was just writing that quote down.
Is that right? Yeah. But I think that this is what's gotten really bad about this now. The most recent wrinkle is that because of the fact that we have this kind of misinformation, now people can propagate and give even true information the label of misinformation,
yeah.
which makes it so much more difficult to be able to parse what is true and what is fake in this particular context. And that, I think, is particularly true for this cycle. That's new in this cycle.
I do. I think it's helpful that schools, undergraduate, high schools, graduate programs are educating young people mm-hmm. on how to identify and be critical of mis and disinformation. Yeah. But I do think that generations sort of outside of that yeah. reach yeah. are still struggling to, know to or to think to fact check the images that are coming through. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I think those images are not actually intended to convince people that Harris was giving a speech at a communist rally or that yeah. or that Taylor Swift endorsed yeah. Trump. I think it's yeah. just to plant the idea yeah. and then the idea itself creates right. its own narrative right. in exactly. the viewers
yeah.
and kind of attaches in an unconscious bias way.
Well, I was just going to say that one of the other things why I use that example
yes.
is that on my phone yesterday came up a notification that had been posted on Truth Social. So, and I do not remember the culprit because it came to me from Apple News as a notification, mm-hmm. but it was either Huffington Post, Time Magazine, or the Wall Street Journal. I think I know who. Anyway, but I mean, the fact that you're covering it as well, right?
Yes.
I mean, the fact that the press is then covering that
yes.
Would I have known otherwise that it was out there?
Yeah.
Probably not had it not been delivered to my phone.
Right. So that speaks to the notion that, you know, everyone has the right to freedom of speech, but the distinction is freedom of reach. And when you have certain platforms that then amplify these messages,
that's good. And that's
what that's the argument of taking it further. And, you know, is it responsible for us to propagate things? And that's also a paradox, because if your goal is, and, you know, some of our colleagues in the communication have been very involved with factcheck.org and so on, and a lot of it is, are you contributing to the problem when you go out and say this piece of information is misinformation, and thereby telling more people about the information that you are labeling as misinformation?
I would not have known about that Harris communist post but for this conversation, because my algorithms would never have shown it to me, right? Mm-hmm. It's not on my social media.
Well, that makes me feel bad.
No, but you are propagating disinformation.
Well, but my
communism.
Well, but what, you know, but this is one of the problems, Joe, which is that these things get picked up by other media.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, I learned about that also through, you know, a news story from one of the actually major papers. And then what happens is that stuff then gets picked up on a Fox or something like that, where what they're able to say is this is being accused of being fake news.
Or right.
This is, you know, in other words, they're spinning things. And then, you know, the part that stuns me is we keep, on this show, we usually criticize Fox as a right-wing station. There's a bunch of the right wingers who think of Fox as
not right wing enough.
CNN. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, there are stations
fair and balanced. The slogan they've used.
Yeah, I mean, it's stunning. And same thing out on social media. So, as Nash knows, I occasionally have to go crawling in the muck of some of these social media things that are scary. We were looking at some of where the whole QAnon thing came mm-hmm. from and mm-hmm. how that spread. And, you know, to do it, we had to look at things called 8chan, which most people haven't heard of. And I'm blanking on the name, Nash. What was the right-wing equivalent of Twitter that, or Facebook? Anyway, there was something that got taken down after January 6th. We have the whole corpus of what had been on there when it was taken down. Mm. And just going through it, it's scary, because what you see is a few manipulators mm-hmm. who are able to get a lot of other people to repeat what they say, and then it comes back to them, and they say, you know, we heard that, right? Yeah. So they kind of deny that they created it, and it really gets these complicated feedback loops. But some of this stuff is scary. And you know, that's coming out now a little bit more in the media, because almost all of these shooters, almost all of these real crazies who've been caught, you know, that's where they dwelt. And then, you know, sort of they put stuff onto their Facebook page, but it came from this really. This isn't even talking about what's called the dark web, which is we're just definitely not going down there. But it really is a time where understanding this stuff is going to be important. Nash mentioned web science before.
Yep.
And we were seeing kind of a decline in people paying attention to that. And now it's growing again. Our audiences are growing. Our you know, the number of people who are engaging in it. Because the understanding of how social media is impacting society has just grown tremendously.
So obviously, Nash, you study this, you look at this, we know what a lot of the problems are, we know what's going out. So how do we as citizens, both active and even inactive, will look and of what we can do to try to be good internet citizens, to understand what is being conveyed to us?
That's an incredibly important question, and a tough question. I think there's a recognition that this is a socio-technical problem, and that is the solutions have to include both social issues and technical issues as you look at this. Nick talked about the fact that the younger generation is being educated in schools and being told what to do, etc. That is part of the solution. We shouldn't make the assumption that young people are always savvier about this. Work that has been done by one of my colleagues, Esther Hargitay, shows that the general notion that young people are very savvy on this and old people are not is actually not true, that young people can also make big mistakes on these issues. So digital literacy, being able to know how to read and how to parse out what is fact versus misinformation or disinformation is certainly a big part of that issue. Another part of it is having institutions like factcheck.org and other kinds of platforms that are going to try to look at being able to provide us some guidance on it. The social media and traditional media platforms have a role where they are now being asked to flag what they consider as misinformation. I think it's striking that in this cycle, we routinely have media sources saying so-and-so has said a lie about this or continues to say this lie. I think that, you know, three presidents ago, we would not have said that about our presidents, but now, or former presidents. But now it's quite routine to be able to say it. So there is that aspect of it. And then I saved the technology for last. I said it's a socio-technical problem, but the technology also can play an important role in helping us decide and helping us be more cautious about it. There's the notion of water printing of watermarks that you can put so that you can say that detect automatically whether something was created or generated through using AI technologies in addition. So I don't think the solution is any one of these, but it's all of these different things: digital literacy, social media platforms, third-party institutions,
regulation,
and regulation, of course, is what brings a lot of this together. Thank you.
I mean, the scary thing too, though, we were talking to Marty Baron of the Washington Post, Boston Globe, and Miami Herald yesterday. He has a new book out called Collision of Power. And we had an interesting discussion, but one of the things that he brought up at his time at the New York Times as Trump was starting his ascent is that they began the fact-checking. And they ended up with 30,000 within the first term, 30,000 lies. But here's what they found. Nobody cared. We've identified them.
Yeah.
We've identified this as fake. We've identified this as not true. Mm-hmm. We've identified this as being a fallacy. Okay.
Yep.
Now what do you got?
You're right. Three presidents ago is probably about right. We were very hesitant. I was on the editorial board as this and the editorial page as this evolution occurred, but we just never used the word lie, liar, anything like that in the past. Mm-hmm. And it actually predated Trump that I persuaded the board we should put this in an editorial. It was when the Senate majority in New York pledged, they actually took an oath that they would put in an independent redistricting process in New York if they were reelected. They came, this is a big, statement that they made, and then they, the day after the election or within very shortly after the election, they said, oh, wait, we can't do that. We just realized there's something in the Constitution that prevents us. And I said, we have to call these guys what they are. They were liars. And here's how I justified that. They took an oath. They signed it. And they said, this is a sacred oath we're taking. I said, you can't. It's nothing but a lie if you break your oath. So we started using that. And then Trump came along. And now 30,000? It becomes so trivial.
Yes.
The word lie. The word disinformation, the word false statement. What do you do when nobody cares about that? I've had multiple arguments on the internet where someone will start an argument with me, and I'm like, 30,000 lies. This is what you want in a president? Well, yeah, but you're not talking about the policy on this. And it's like, I don't want to talk about the policy on this. I want to talk about the overall character of this person. And the overall character of this person is that he is a the adjective is just on the tip of my tongue, and I can't use it.
There is actually a technical term for it, and in the communications and philosophy space, which we can't use on the radio, it's abbreviated BS. But if you actually look at Google Scholar, Google Scholar is something that we use to see how many publications on a particular topic and how many citations they've gotten. That word has been in philosophy for about 15, 20 years now. The top paper on it is a seminal paper, has thousands of citations. Citation is someone else mentioning in their paper. And it's all about the difference between someone who's lying in the sense of, I'm trying to fool you into something, and somebody who is just making a statement that sounds correct and they don't care. And that's really the issue, I think.
And that's that partly the communist flag thing,
yeah, exactly.
Is that even when I find a lot of discussions with people where they repeat a lie and then you call them out on it, and you say, this has been fact checked. Mm-hmm. This has been, and here's the fact check if you want to go do it. And then they're like, yeah, but you know what? It would be true. It feels true, and this is an example. All right, it's an exaggerated one, and I was just joking. But you know, what are you doing that?
But yeah. I think that there's an assumption we are making, which psychologists know not to be true, and that is that if you give people the facts, it'll always rule. Right. And Bob Cialdini, who is a psychologist, has written extensively and reviewed the literature on this extensively, that some people have a desire to be right, mm-hmm. and others have a desire to be liked. And if you talk to somebody and you say, oh, if I can just give you the facts on climate change, shouldn't you change your mind? And they go, no, but I'm entitled to my beliefs. Mm-hmm. I don't care about the facts. And I think we make the mistake that just because you give somebody facts, that's automatically going to work. And the more important psychology shows that sometimes people are more likely to be persuaded to do something, to be influenced, not by giving them facts because they don't have a desire to be right, but by giving them friendship, giving them adulation because they have a desire to be liked. Mm-hmm. And I think politicians and campaigners and people in marketing have long understood that influence has to be understood both as an ensemble of fact, but also other strategies that are not based entirely on fact.
I mentioned earlier Stephanie Grisham, who is former press secretary for President Trump, and she spoke at the Democratic National Convention last night. And she said that the president said to her, Stephanie, you have to go out and you have to say this. This is after January 6th. And she said, but it's not true. And he said, if you say it enough, it becomes true. Mm-hmm. And she said, I couldn't bring myself to doing it. So, I mean, part of the problem, too, is that you need more people to say, I can't bring myself to doing that, which is an issue. Nick.
Yeah, and I wanted actually to go back to the notion that some people just want to be liked. I think they also want to do, like, they want the response expected from them mm-hmm. to be a thing that's comfortable yeah. for them to do.
Yes.
So with climate change, it's one right. thing to say there's climate change and we're all facing mass extinction. It's another thing to say, you know, you can take these very small, comfortable steps and
yes.
you don't have to turn your whole life
yes.
upside down.
Yes.
So it has the truth has to connect also to an action that people are comfortable with,
yes.
because if the truth is too far
yeah.
away from that,
yeah.
you just lose that connection.
So
right?
I'll give an example of
this
that.
And I think that is the liked. It's not just mm-hmm. that they want to like the fact or they'll like the person.
Yes. Yes.
They also want to like the answer.
And they want to like themselves. They want to reduce the dissonance. So there was a study done for a political campaign a few decades ago where if you went to a neighborhood and asked people, would you be willing to support my candidate by simply signing this petition in support of this person? And some people did, and some people did not. And then they went to a different neighborhood. Oh, so they came back to that same neighborhood a week later and said, do you mind if we put a sign outside in your yard in support of this candidate? And many of those who had signed it said, sure, you can put us, because by now it was being internally consistent. They were taking these small steps that you said, Nick. They agreed to sign it first, and now they said, well, if I signed it, I'm more likely now, I'm open to the idea of putting a placard. They went to a different neighborhood and didn't start with the request for the signature, just went directly to, can we put a sign in your yard? A vast majority of the people said no.
Right.
So this idea that you raised, Nick, of comfort level, of building it slowly, of starting with small steps and adding more, it works very effectively that reason.
Yeah, and also, yeah. you know, branding. So I mentioned this, I think, last show, so I won't go into it in depth, but there was a study where, you know, the Republicans significantly prefer the Affordable Care Act to Obamacare.
Right.
Right. Whereas, you know,
Obama mentioned that.
Yeah, I was a little sad it's not Obamacare anymore.
But it literally just calling it
labels.
That made it a political issue. I know this isn't the book show, Joe, but Fauci's book On Call is worth reading. It starts out very much as a page turner, gets a little clunky in the middle where it's going through a lot of just the politics of various things. But when it gets to the Trump era, you really get a feel for what was going on, and that Trump was saying these horrible things to Fauci in public and then calling him up and saying these really nice things to him on the phone. And it's just you're reading this and you're like, this is unbelievable what's going on. He's turning this person into a national anathema at the same time that he's saying, yes, I know you're right, but I don't care. Yes, you know, what you've been doing for...
That's what he's doing with the vaccines, too, right? He's saying we should be more cautious about vaccines, and vaccines, you know, like skepticism is healthy. And other days he's like, I gave you the vaccines. I saved your lives. I mean, he really tries to take both approaches depending on who's listening, which, I mean, isn't uncommon for politicians, right? That's a really typical and traditional approach to speeches. You give a different speech in a different audience. I just think his is just so stark. It's very...
Just a quick break, and then... Miriam Adelson, you know, trying to figure out, like, what he... Okay. we'll take a break. And we'll be right back and continue after this.
No matter how much I'm gone, it always looks the same. Time still feels like it stood still. Rolling slowly by each landmark, calling out my name.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last moments with our great group this morning. Nosh Contractor, Jim Henler, Jay Jochnowitz, and Nick Rangel. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Quick programming note coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. We'll have a one-hour special remembering the life of Dr. Alice Green, who passed away yesterday at the age of 84. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. In the time that we have left, let's get to other subjects. There are other subjects. they're still political, but I think we can certainly would like to take a crack at a couple of these. So the the gift that keeps on giving. RFK. So the running mate for RFK. Nicole Shanahan was on a podcast, and they, of course, have been denying all along that they're playing the role of spoiler. And so now and you'll remember that there was a Kennedy campaign official who gave this presentation laying out how they could help Trump. And the Kennedy campaign distanced itself from them. But now Kennedy's vice presidential running mate, Nicole Shanahan, has dropped any pretense. She indicated in a new podcast interview that the Kennedy campaign would prefer to help Trump than see Vice President Kamala Harris win the presidency. And she even floated the idea that she and Kennedy could drop out of the race to assist in that outcome. This was on the Impact Theory podcast. Shanahan laid out two paths forward for the Kennedy campaign, trying to get enough votes to form a more robust third party or dropping out to help Trump.
I think it was interesting that the Kennedy campaign, from what I read, also offered the possibility that it would endorse Harris. He would drop out and endorse Harris if she offered him an appropriate job in the in the administration, and they didn't bite. RFK, is apparently for sale to the highest bidder at this point, and I'm very pleased that at least one campaign said sorry. No. You know, the guy is, I'm sorry, the guy's a nut. And Trump has been courting him. We heard the phone call that somebody had kindly recorded while Trump was on, and just listened to this smarmy politician trying to find a way to convince Kennedy that he was sort of on his in the ballpark on vaccines, that there was a way that Donald Trump could help carry the anti-vax message by saying, well, we can't give kids too many vaccines at once. That's Trump's idea. I mean, totally unscientific idea. I would love to see Kennedy out of the race at this point. And if he goes over to Trump, great.
I do think there was one interesting line. Well, there were a lot of interesting lines in that whole interview with her. But one is, we're looking at these different options. One is to form a new party, but we run the risk of taking votes from Trump. And in fact, most of the polling shows that when you add Kennedy into the mix, it used to help Trump when it was against Biden. Now it's not. It looks like it may draw more votes from Trump. So, you know, he suddenly becomes a very odd player in this whole thing. And my guess is, given that they've now made it so he can't get on most of the major states, it's going to be really hard for him to decide to try to stay on in any way unless something weird happens, which never happens in these days in politics, like, say, a Supreme Court ruling or something.
Well, anything you wanted to...
No, I was going to mention that analysis that Shanahan had, like, really described in detail, like, realizing that earlier in the campaign, their campaign was taking votes from Biden, but now it is mostly taking votes from Trump. And I think that also means that they have more to gain if they join forces with Trump. Trump is more desperate for those votes and would be more open and willing to negotiating a buyout? I mean, whatever, a consolation prize.
Something that gives him Kennedy just seems to want some legitimacy in life.
He is bringing $3.5 million with him, that he would be kind of shifting over to Trump. So I think, there's some argument there. I do also think that the undecided vote is a really interesting group of people. I know earlier this week, Libby Post was talking about the standard was like a 30% of voters are undecided. And we think that's a smaller group in this election cycle. But what we heard from Trump's ex-press secretary, Grisham, and what I think is true, and we're seeing a lot, is that there are these silent voters who live in Republican households, largely women, who are not being represented in the polls, who are definitely not, Kennedy supporters, and who are likely to vote for Harris on issues like, abortion protection and bodily autonomy, and they're this big group of voters that I think Trump is scrambling to figure out how to reach. And I think that's part of the Taylor Swift deep fake or whatever, right? He's just desperate to reach this group of people in more remote, more rural, and more conservative voting blocks that he just has no shot at. He doesn't even know how to connect with, right? Or how to speak to them. I mean, he's just railing on this on immigration and crime. And I think Harris has a lot of very strong language around both of those in response, and particularly after Trump admitted that he intentionally tanked a strong immigration bill, right? So
Donna writes to us and says, good morning. The BBC World News this morning characterized last night's DNC gathering as a, quote, love-in, and, quote, quivering with energy. Yes, we needed it, and yes, the Brits can be as cynical, caustic, and sarcastic. Much has been said about how the world views our politics as entertainment. What say you, panelists? Any memorable moments to support this claim? Question mark. Please reference media in your response. That's a very professorial question and request, isn't it?
I mean, the convention is entertainment. I mean, that's the whole point
it's
of it.
Show.
It is
a show.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. I did actually come in with quite a bit of research on the policy initiatives coming out of the Harris campaign, particularly around housing and affordability. I've got lots of notes. I even, you know, had it propped up. But that's not what this moment is. This moment is energy. It's charisma. It's getting people who were going to sit out to now not sit out and show up.
I could have thrown you a question about.
Listen, I just really love housing policy. You know, that's my background, and I was like, really went down the rabbit hole. Like,
so let me ask
7 a.m.
Let me ask you this question: Is that a rabbit hole that you think a lot of people will be going down? One that will make a difference in the race?
Yeah, I mean, the kind of key pieces there, housing affordability, we know coming out of the pandemic that there's a huge bubble, right, with people who bought outside of their price range with the extremely low interest rates and are facing growing interest rates that are probably variable for a lot of people. So there is going to be, there's a lot of projections that there's a lot of housing crisis on the horizon, and also a deep, deep lack of available housing to meet the need of working people, right? The working class people need places to live where jobs are, and the development is stagnated and has really been at tragically low rates. And interestingly, in states like Florida, where Florida's governor is going after undocumented people, construction sites have come to a halt. So you had, at one point, states like Florida outgrowing the housing market compared to New York State, where then the shift in policy really kind of paused that housing development in those states. So there is a lot of conversation that is and should be happening around housing affordability. But the ideas coming out are super interesting, right? There's the transit-oriented development, it's conversion development. It's a lot of stuff New York State has been working on since the Senate Democrats took the majority, has been around development, and even Hochul's housing policy proposal last year that failed and was reinvigorated this year with some new initiatives. Like there's a lot of policy in the Harris plan that's coming out of states like New York and California that are really driving some innovative approaches to using federal tax incentives to build more units. But other things, medical debt skyrocketed during the COVID pandemic. I have lots of personal stories about medical debt, but my disability, but it's going to resonate with a lot of people because of the particular state of household economics coming out of the pandemic. I think the medical debt idea, which kind of mimics a little bit the student debt concept where you're leveraging public dollars to buy debt, I think these things are really interesting ideas. And I think once we get past the convention, which is all razzle dazzle, we're going to dig into some of those policy ideas, and I'm excited about them.
Well, I'm glad you are, and I hope the audience is. And so next week, less razzle dazzle.
You
promise you all. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Jim, Jay, Nick, thank you. And Nosh, what a delight to meet you. Thank you very much for being on the show. Come back anytime you want to, or if Jim wants you to, and we'd love to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this. Thanks to Jim, but thanks to all of you for giving me this opportunity. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Great thrill. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.